Hey, hi, hello. This is Scriptlock, where we talk about storytelling in video games. I'm Nick Folkman.
And I'm Max Folkman. Today's guests are Ollie Moss and Alex Naonike. Ollie is a graphic designer best known for his work with Mondo, Harry Potter, Star Wars, the Academy Awards, and much more. He previously was the art director on Firewatch and is a notorious Garfield aficionado. Alex is a UI designer and illustrator at Naughty Dog, as well as a freelance children's book author. Her credits include The Last of Us, The Last of Us Left Behind, Uncharted 4, Uncharted The Lost Legacy, and NBA Live 09.
I didn't know that. That's incredible. I have questions, but we'll come back to that.
I do too. Yeah. Okay. So before we get into that, this episode is going to be different from our usual stuff because for two special reasons. One is we're talking to artists instead of writers or designers because we want to acknowledge that they aren't the only ones influencing the storytelling of a video game. And it's important to hear other perspectives. The other reason is that we all spent our formative years on the same message board and ended up working in the same industry, and that's bananas. So thank you for coming on.
Yeah, I think that is going to become much more common of like people coming up together in the same like online communities.
Yeah. I hope so.
Right, I feel like it's especially now with Twitter and the people that I've sort of made friends with through there, but even when we were younger and all in the same place, like I feel that it's really good. I'm rambling. Just go on. Like start asking me questions, please.
And also, we lived with Alex when we first moved out to LA. When we all went out to LA, and that was awesome. And we didn't know we were going to work in games. And we also had never met each other in person before. And felt like, yeah, we're all cool. This will work, right?
I think we all thought we were going to work in movies because I, at the time, was going for animation viz dev. But yeah. I had worked in games previously, and I moved down here to do viz dev. And then I was like, nah, I'm just going to stick with games forever.
But you were coming back after doing like workshops with Glenn Keane at night, which sounded always amazing.
Oh, no, it wasn't Glenn Keane. It was Bill Perkins that I did workshops with. Yeah. And then Nico Marley, I was talking to him a little bit too, getting feedback from him and stuff. So it was very like I came down here for that reason. And then I was like, it's too good here to leave.
I do regret that Alex would do these incredible sketches and that you would just throw them away in our garbage. And I never saved any of them because they're so good. I still regret that.
I would have given them to you. I probably wouldn't have. I would have been like, no, I'll draw you something better. Then I would have like never felt like I could have drawn something better. So you just never would get anything from me.
Yeah, probably. But go ahead, Ollie, what were you guys?
Oh, I was going to say, meanwhile, while you were all living in the same house and throwing away beautiful sketches, I was in another part of LA working at Prologue Movies, doing like storyboarding for title sequences. I had the exact opposite reaction to LA, which was, I hate this. I want to leave. This is awful. Please take me away from here.
And then you did.
And I did. I fucked off immediately. I think I was at that job for like 6 months, and I was just, it's not for me.
Oh, wow. I love LA. For the first like 2 months, I guess, I didn't really like it very much because it felt really lonely. But then I was like, oh man, it's not like, I'm from Nova Scotia, Canada, where you get pretty awful winters, and then it's like generally pretty yucky except for a late spring and summer. And so I was like, this place is perfect, I'm never leaving this place.
I liked the place. It was the job that killed me.
Fair.
Yeah, it's like VFX pipelines, very very brutal, and I the burnout rate is crazy.
Yeah
video games aren't brutal at all.
No.
I joke, but
it's a little different in VFX. I mean, it's like the projects are shorter, but there's enough of them that you're crunching all the time. There's no period of where you're not crunching. You're sort of expected to show up, work at a place for a year, then take a big break and like leave.
Yeah, true. Okay, Max, I want to ask your NBA Live Jet question. Yeah, so Alex,
did you design the characters?
No, so I worked on my very first job in games was in 2007, and it was like, we were working on ports of NBA Live for, it's for EA, obviously, but it's a small company called HB Studios, and like, I was doing the PSP UI, so like, the PSP version of NBA Live 2009, I did the UI port.
Incredible.
Amazing.
Okay, so like, are you trying to replicate like the UI for sport, like American sports? Because like, let's talk about the UI for sports because it's just like all brushed metal and like swooping.
Yes.
Oh yeah, it's always like the sickest possible thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you know what's crazy is I always feel like the UI for sports, like sports games have way more than UI than most other games, and you can play the entire game in the UI. Like you can, you don't have to actually go in and like do the sport. Like you can simulate it. Like a lot of people just simulate the results, mm-hmm. which I found really crazy. So it's like all, it's like very, very UI heavy. I have a lot of respect for people that, that like do the actual mod-ported version of those games.
Oh, you mean like if they want to play it as a manager or something and they can just like play it and sim out the, oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, there's like a whole like, well, at least, I mean, I haven't played a sports game since I was working on them, but there was like a manager mode where, yeah, you did that. You just simulated the game. It was like two games in one. If you like sports. But yeah, it was like really tact. I mean, that was 2007, so all the UI looked tactile. Like everything looked like a thing. And now it's all like, you know, it got, it had some sense. It like grew up a little bit, like stopped trying to look like an object and started like just focusing more on what the purpose of it is. God, I shouldn't say it got. I've already done something bad. I've already done something regrettable.
That's true, though.
It's like it just kind of caught up with graphic design, I guess, because before it was lagging behind with like graphic design trends. It was just like, it's a video game. Make it look like brushed metal and paper and stuff.
Do you watch American sports now?
No, goodness.
But you still watch hockey? Do you watch hockey? I can't remember.
I every now and again during like the like the end of hockey, I'll watch it sometimes because like my family's really into it. But no, I don't.
Do you have a question you're going to with that, Max?
I forgot though. all right. So then, how did you break into games then, Alex? How'd you get that job?
Oh man, I studied neuroscience and biology in school in Canada, and like 4 years into that, I was like, I don't want to go to med school, and I don't want to be a researcher. And a girl I knew who worked at like an HR company or PR company, I mean, was like, oh, there's this game studio in town, and they're hiring graphic artists. And I was like, I don't know what that is, but I have a portfolio of like, I had enough work from just like messing around on there, and I like put together a portfolio, and I applied, and they were like, yeah, all right, you could probably do this. And they sort of taught me all the stuff I needed to know while I was there.
Were you doing your Valentine's around this time?
They started then. Yeah. Yeah. They started like, I think right before I got the job, and I did the Valve ones, like the TF2 ones, a couple months after I got the job. Yeah. So yeah. Yep. It was about that time.
Awesome. We'll link to those in the show notes because they still look great.
Yeah. I remember those. I remember really loving those back in the day.
Oh, I remember how excited you were when you got to visit Valve after like, doing those Valentine's.
I mean, they gave me a contract that lasted right up until I got the job at Naughty Dog. Like I did marketing art for them, and I designed some of their plush toys and stuff. Oh, so yeah. I did those like fan art stuff. And then Valve was like, cool. Yeah. It's like, you can work for us doing that stuff. So fan art's cool.
They made a boomer plush toy off of your design, right?
Yeah. And I did all of the Left 4 Dead infecteds, and I had to like, I don't remember, I think I did the Wheatley design too that they ended up making into a thing, but I think someone else also worked on that, like someone else took over on that one, but yeah, I had plush toys and like little band, like for their store, like banner illustrations and stuff.
And that was your second gaming job?
Yeah. And that it was like it was kind of a freelance basis, so it wasn't like steady or anything like that. But then I also worked on some like Facebook and mobile games while I was down here before I worked at Naughty Dog.
What kind of jobs were you doing for those? Like graphic design?
Yeah, I was UI designer. On those things, and they never saw the light of day. I think one of them was on Facebook for like a hot second, and then it got taken off. So, yeah.
We'll talk about more about UI design in a bit, but first, Ollie, I know you've done interviews where you talked about this in podcasts, but just because we ask everyone, how did you get into games?
Oh, how I got into games? Games was kind of a late thing for me. I got into games through, I became Twitter friends with a guy called Jake Rodkin, who was working on The Walking Dead game at the time. I think I Oh no, it was before that. It was when he was working on Sam and Max season 3. I was a big fan of the Telltale games at the time because they were like the only people making new adventure games, which is kind of what I grew up playing, and I really enjoyed them. And I think I did a sort of tweet, just said, "Hey, I think Telltale are doing a brilliant job on Sam and Max season 3, and I think everyone should play it because it's really creative and interesting sort of like I guess evolution of the adventure game at that point. They were doing some really really fun and interesting stuff in that game that I hadn't seen done before, and Jake reached out because he liked, I think he followed me already. He liked my work. He's really into sort of packaging design and graphic stuff, which is what I was doing at the time. And we just sort of like got talking about possibly working on some Telltale stuff together, which never saw the light of day. We never actually did anything with it. But it was clear that he was a guy that I could go to for like to get feedback on what I was working on, because there's a point, like, we all came from this forum, right, where we were sharing our work and we all like made each other better by getting that really really good feedback. But when you start working on commercial projects and you're signing NDAs, you don't necessarily get that anymore. So he was like one of those people that I suddenly realized would give me really good feedback on what I was working on. We build a really good friendship up through just like showing each other stuff that we were working on and getting feedback on it. And that relationship carried on for a really long time. And eventually he said, you know, we're thinking about breaking off and doing our own video game thing. Would you be interested in possibly coming on to work with us in some capacity? I met Jake and Sean Vanneman, his writing partner, when they were down in London to receive the BAFTA for Game of the Year for Walking Dead Season 1. And we just had a really, really good time. We all clicked creatively. And we just took it from there. And eventually, probably 3 years later, we put out Firewatch.
Awesome.
So cool.
Okay, I have a question for both of you that first relates to Ollie, but I want to hear what you think too, Alex. During development of Firewatch, Jane Ng, Campo Santo's lead artist, said, "A lot of video games look video gamey because designers are told, we can't do this, we can't do that. You pigeonhole yourself into a certain look. Part of the reason we have a fresh look is because Ollie is not limited by what he thinks is possible." So, like, Ollie, now that you've worked on a game and have been doing a lot of 3D modeling yourself,
mm-hmm.
you have a better idea of what's possible. Do you feel that that has limited your creativity at all?
No, I don't. I think it's the opposite, in fact. Really? It's knowing what's possible is like, I mean, it's changed the way I think about it for sure. But I think if we went back and made Firewatch now, given the knowledge that I have and having made it and the stuff I've been teaching myself since that game has been released, I think the game would probably look better and I would have been a bit more forceful about certain things that I wanted. I think having the experience in a different industry certainly helps, but I don't necessarily think being ignorant of the tools being made is like a benefit, you know?
Yeah, but I can also understand like maybe preliminarily blocking yourself from going down a path because you know that it probably wouldn't work out that way.
I think there are definitely best practices. Like, people in video games definitely get really into a mindset of like, what can and can't be done, and then someone coming in and saying like, actually I want it to look like this, I want it to look a little different, or I want to achieve a different effect than what you're used to is usually a successful like recipe for something new happening. But I don't know, I feel like if we went back and made Firewatch now, it would certainly be it wouldn't look different. I wouldn't be like, yeah, everything's gonna look fucking photorealistic and sick because I now know how to like 3D scan a rock, you know, like I'm not gonna it's not gonna be that. I don't think that statement is necessarily is. I mean, at the time it felt correct, but going back, I think in retrospect, I would have liked to have known more about the process of making video games going into that game.
Yeah, and for like at least for UI, at Naughty Dog, at least like it was always, hey, I'd like to try to do this thing, and then I work with programmers, and they're like, oh yeah, we could probably figure out how to do that. So that's kind of like the relationship there. Like, there's definitely things that just can't get done, and you learn those things pretty quickly. But as far as like innovating, like, it's sometimes the programmers will come to me and be like, hey, I was thinking it'd be cool if we could like figure out how to do this thing. Do you think we would need that? Like, so it's kind of, it depends on the team, I think. Like, I really, really, really enjoyed working with the programmers, particularly for Uncharted 4 and Last of Us UI, because they're so willing to like kind of help you figure out how to do something, like if you can't already, if there are limitations to it. So yeah, I don't know that I've had, I would agree with Ollie on that one, that it's like, I didn't know anything going in. And now that I know a lot about like how stuff works and like why certain things have to be a certain way, I think that it just makes me work faster and more efficiently.
Okay. Would you say like, has there been any negative effect of having too much knowledge?
I think, yeah, sometimes I'll be like, oh, I don't think that I get what she's saying. Like, I could definitely see myself being like, I'm not even going to try that because I don't think that we can do that. Like, for sure. But I don't know that that's a negative necessarily. I can't think of any examples.
Right. It's not really, this isn't necessarily a negative. It depends on, I guess, what you want to do with your career and your creative output. But I think there's certainly a case with video game art and technical art specifically where people can get very, very detail oriented in a way that is a bit myopic. Especially like 3D modelers get really, really excited about making the most photorealistic version of a thing and spending loads and loads of time on a single asset and just getting really and getting lost in the process and the idea, because there's so much to learn in asset creation, like 3D production. There's so many different packages, different software packages that you can get lost in the idea of like learning how to do everything and making everything perfect, and you kind of lose sight of the bigger picture, I think is a thing that I've seen happen to a lot of video game artists.
Yeah, and I don't know if this has been, if you guys know this yet, but I've like started to move out of the UI department. I'm now like a full-time character concept artist at Naughty Dog, which is kind of what I'd wanted to do, but you know, I fell into UI, and our character pipeline is really interesting because we like do mostly photo scanning of like character stuff. So like we find doubles and all this stuff and like scan them. And it means that like our art style, like as concept artists, can be more about like storytelling and less about getting it exactly realistic, like because the modelers aren't going to take necessarily what we make and turn it into an actual thing. It's just like we use that to kind of more, it's more of like story driven concept art now for character, not for environment.
Right. One of the fascinating things about that pipeline that I remember you telling me was that you now have shoppers to like go out and you say roughly what you want a character to be wearing, and they'll go out and like find real clothes and then dress a model and 3D scan it, which I think is awesome. And
yeah, there's pictures of me. I have to see if I could like find them because they're really funny. Wearing like, they'll put me in the costumes and I'll like stand on the thing and like get scanned. And there's that, I have like a face scan that looks really, really bad because I made a bad face and I made that my profile picture for a while. Yeah, I mean, it's just a, like, as our games became more realistic, like the pipeline had to change. But instead of like concept artists like struggling to like change and be more photorealistic, we found like a different avenue, which is why I'm able to do what I do there, because my work's pretty stylized. It's like not super realistic, but I can still like contribute to that team in a pretty meaningful way by doing like story work and talking more about like why the character is dressing a certain way versus like what this fabric specifically is.
Right. It was really fascinating to see the work that you did designing the young versions of Nate and his brother in that game. Because obviously the drawings that you did were much more stylized than the result, but it felt like all the personality was there.
Yeah, and that's so like what I wanted to do, and I never thought that I could do that in a company like this because of that barrier of like, well, like how are they going to turn it into something? And they were able to turn it into something meaningful. Like, you know, when I work with the creative director, with the writer, and I'm able to illustrate something that they're, you know, work that character that they're working on, they're able to look at it and be like, oh yeah, that's what I want them to feel like. And then they do end up passing that on to like animators and like other people in the team to try to like make it feel that way.
Right. Because a lot of the time it's about trying to communicate a feeling that a writer or a creative director is trying to get across to you that, and they don't necessarily have the tools with which to communicate it themselves. But a lot of the time you're kind of chasing the feeling that they're going after with your with your work in a way that communicates it to the people that then have to go and produce the thing that ends up in the product.
Yeah. And a lot of those things came pretty late too. Like the ones of like Drake, Nate and Cassie's rooms, those were like fairly into production. And it was originally that Neil asked me just to design their rooms. And so then I was like, well, like, what are their, how can you like inject their personality into that, into these spaces and things like that. So it's not even just like at the beginning, like those things carry through right through to production, like the end of production.
I have a question related to all this, like okay. That'd be for both of you. As an artist, what do you think is your most important tool when you're trying to tell a story with an image or get across an idea? Like, is it composition?
Oh man, value? Like it just depends on what you're trying to communicate, right? I never go into a job thinking, I'm all about the composition. This is going to be the most, like, you just need to figure out what it is that the thing is saying, and you use whatever you have in your toolbox that communicates that in the most effective way. Like, sometimes it will be about the composition if they're looking for some like really constructivist piece of art or like a really impactful visual moment, but other times it might be about the color. It might be like the color, it might be the feeling that you get from a certain like color palette. It could be anything, and the best art directors, the people that have the range to bring all of that stuff to the table when it's required, I think.
Yeah, I usually approach like how I'm going to do an image based on like what it is they need. So it's like trying to get across like this really emotional moment between characters. It's like, okay, like if it's like kind of more serious, then a lot of it comes down to like the lighting and the framing. If it's more like just trying to establish who they are, then maybe it's more like color and stuff. Like, it just really, like Ollie said, super depends on what it is, like what the problem is. And then I'll be like, it's also like time stuff too. So it's like, okay, we need these like quick studies of these characters, and I'm just going to like no background, just like two characters interacting with like a lot of like focus on facial expression and posing and stuff, versus like if it's, I have a bit more time, then it'd be like, I try to like film still type things where I focus a lot on like the camera angle and lighting.
Because any way you slice it in a production environment, time is really, really important. And if you can communicate what needs to be communicated in a quick pencil sketch on a napkin, then you do that rather than waste your time like making a beautiful style frame if you don't need to.
Yeah, some of mine are so messy.
Oh god, people kept saying like, when are we going to see the Art of Firewatch book? And I'm like, never, never, you'll never see it because it's all terrible.
Once I go back and finish them, yeah, you'll exactly. see it.
What do you two worry the most about when you're like working on an image? Does it stay the same or does it change based on the... It
depends object? On the purpose of the image. If I'm working on like a poster that is designed to be on a wall or like to sell a poster to somebody, it'll just be like, does it work? Is it effective? Like, would I hang this in my house? Is it like a good image? Whereas if it's a silly joke, it'll be like, is it funny? If it's a piece of concept art for a video game, it's like, does this communicate what it needs to the production artist? It really, really depends.
Yeah, same. It's like, what's the purpose? And with art for games, it's like, what point in the production are we at? So like, is it, you know, telling the story, or is it going to give the people that need to work on this what they need to know? With children's book stuff, it's like completely different. Like, it's this very dissonant life that I have right now where it's like working on Last of Us 2 during the day and then like children's books at night. Because they're completely different. There's a lot of emphasis on like making the characters really stand out and like making it like there's like this thing in children's books where like you always want the characters to be kind of like looking towards the next pages and like things like that, like that you have to think about, and knowing your audience, like you have to keep them entertained because they're young, and like there's just, it really just depends on what it is that I'm trying to do. I'm always stressed about art though. That's a guarantee.
Oh yeah, I'm super stressed about it. Like that, yeah, that's the constant, is that I'm just really worried about it all the time.
That's everyone who's been on this podcast. We're all stressed all the time.
It's always like, oh man, I'm like bad at this. Like, why are they letting me?
yep. I'm working on a high profile like key art for a Broadway musical right now. And it's like, they approved the sketch and I'm doing it. I'm like, I can't make it work. It's bad. Everything's bad. This is awful. I told them this would take 2 days. It's been a week. And like, I think I've redrawn the same image about 5 times now.
Just I like, hate that. I hate that shit.
And then, yeah, it's the worst.
I'll be like, yeah, this will take me no time at all. Like, I'll look at it and be like, I could do this really quick. And then I go to sit down and do it. And I'm like, what did I do this for? Why did I say this is only going to take me 2 days? Right. It's going to take me forever. I'm horrible at this. This is the worst.
I remember coming off Firewatch, we all sort of did like a debrief about like what it was like to work with someone for 3 years. And that was one of the things that like I got shit for, which was saying like a completely unrealistic, guess on how long things would take. Because I would say, this is impossible. It will take 5 days and I will come back within half a day and be like, oh, I did it. It was much easier than I thought. Or I'll be like, no, piece of cake. And it will be like a week. I have no ability to time things out correctly.
I'm the same. I actually just had a freelance project fall through because this is so important. If you're going to do freelance and your main job at the same time, like don't overpromise, because I just thought that I'd be able to get something done. And I burnt out really hard and with like work, and I like too many projects kind of collided all at once, and they were so understanding and like really cool about it. But yeah, like it can really bite you in the ass. Like yeah. It bit me so bad recently.
I had similar experiences working on Firewatch when I was trying to do everything at the same time. And like the hardest one for me was I was doing the Harry Potter book covers while we were finishing the game.
Oh no.
And that was really, really tough because I wanted to do a really good job, because I was such a big fan of the books growing up, and it was like my dream job, and I pitched really hard for it and I got it. But like ultimately I think the quality of the finish on them was like not what it could have been, because I'm still really proud of them, like I think being that stressed to finish, like but again at the same time, like I don't know, I'm fully aware that I probably would have just redrawn them like a million times and they would still look the same.
Yeah, and that's an interesting point, because I feel the same way about anything I've done with freelance. I'll look at it and like the people that I do it for are so happy with it, and like other people that look at it are like, it's great. But I know, because when I look at those Harry Potter book covers, I think they're perfect. I think they're like my favorite Harry Potter
art
that's come out, and you know how much I love Harry Potter.
We all know how much we
love Harry Potter. I love Harry Potter. But so like, I'm a pretty good judge of Harry Potter. But I think that's just a thing that happens when you burn yourself out and stress yourself out, is you're always thinking while you're doing it, if I had more time, I could do this better. I know I could, but you wouldn't necessarily. Like, I don't know that I would do better if I had more time.
That's my life currently, is I've been very, ever since we shipped Firewatch, I've been trying to take on much less work and just take time for myself to teach myself new stuff and work on things. It's mostly resulted in like terrible looping Garfield GIFs, but it's But it's like some of my favorite stuff that I've made, weirdly. So I'm just really.
I actually deleted a tweet because I thought that it the tone was weird, where I was like, oh my god, this is actually really good. Because I thought at first that you were just like goofing off, but you did the one of like it was like a rock Garfield exploding. And I was like, shit, you're like, you put a lot of time into it. Like, you actually have gotten pretty good at like 3D and whatever is.
I put a lot of time into Garfield trash over the last, but I'm really enjoying it. It's good. For me, it was like the reason that I picked Garfield over anything was that it's stupid and silly and fun, but mostly teaching myself a new thing, it would be very easy to just like fall down. It's like kind of relating back to what we talked about earlier. It would be really easy to like fall down a YouTube tutorial thing and I'd just be making a bunch of like disconnected trash, but instead I'm like trying to find a cohesive through line through a bunch of weird funny projects that make them like feel like a more, I don't know, productive use of my time than just like, I want to get good at something. It's like, I want to get good at something by doing something that like feels like a cohesive project. So that's kind of,
I really loved that you chose to do something like that too, that so like said to me that you were not just out there trying to do something for portfolio or like friend, you were just like, I am having fun with this is something I want to do, so I'm going to do it. Because I think we can all get trapped in that like, oh, I need to like do serious work all the time, like stuff that's going to like do something for like my brand or like my image.
Oh no, this is definitely doing something for my brand. It's destroying it. It's trashing it. It's setting it on fire. Everything's bad now.
I think that it made like I don't know. I think it elevated your brand a little bit. You're very much known as like the Garfield guy now.
Well, that's what I'm hoping is that eventually I can just take it from Jim Davis. I'm hoping that
he's
one
yours.
day. Like I'll be able to argue that I am just as related to the Garfield franchise as Jim Davis.
I think that you brought Garfield back into this generation, so you can be held personally responsible for that. Like nobody gave anything about Garfield.
I don't know. I think it was always there. I think I just tapped into something that was really alive in everybody.
Oh my God, this conversation.
Ollie is like the single-handed Garfield revival man in my
heart.
No,
there's other people that like, there's other, you know, great people doing great Garf works out there.
Garfield
like,
without Garfield?
Oh, Garfield, yeah, without Garfield.
Yeah, exactly. He's
the that's the first, God, that's the modern start.
Yeah. Garfield without Garfield, yeah. That reminds me of that, well, this is very off topic, I'm sorry, but somebody posted recently that like the beginning of millennial humor was that SNL skit of like the dudes all shooting each other to that song, the Imogen Heap song.
I play that song every time I get shot in PUBG on my
you
stream.
Would, yeah.
yeah, I did. I would. That is exactly what I did.
But can I tell you something that I think you'll all appreciate? Because I'm pretty sure like by that point, we were all like well into our careers. I read comments on that because I do that sometimes. And one of them was like, oh man, that's the guy from Portlandia. And I was like, okay. And then the next comment was, yeah, I remember seeing this skit when I was in the fourth grade. And I was like, oh no, oh no. We're olds now.
Oh my God. Don't remind
me. We're old.
The first thing that I remember really like checking out on as an old, you know, you have that first thing that you're like, oh, I don't even care to understand what this is. Was like Bitcoin. And I'm
Bitcoin.
I'm kicking myself with that now, but oh well.
Yeah, I don't. I still don't.
They're like, you could have made it. I'm like, yeah, because like I don't understand the. I tried to read an article about what the blockchain was the other day, and I went, no, I don't know what this is, and I don't care to know.
I did the same thing, and I was like, it was very well described, but I was like, I still don't get it. Like, I don't understand what this is.
There's a Bitcoin ATM at our comic book shop, and it frightens me.
Oh no! What does it give you? Wait, what comes out of it?
I don't know.
His smugness, I think.
I need to know. What comes out of it? Is it USD? Are you converting it in the machine?
I took a photo of it and put it on Instagram, and then that was it. Because it just terrified me. I didn't want to touch it.
Oh, my goodness.
I refuse to engage with this technology, so instead I'm going to post it on my Instagram and laugh at it.
Yeah, that's what
says millennial man.
Bitcoin, this is it. We're old. Like basically the youths are looking at us like we're saying emails instead of text messages. Like that's what this is. Yep. We don't understand cryptocurrency.
It's like our parents saying Pokemon.
Yeah.
Okay, back on topic. Okay.
Sorry.
There's two things I want to backtrack to. I know there's one thing Max wants to backtrack to.
I do.
But when we were talking about being satisfied with your work, I remember that Ollie tweeted like this week about like, have you ever enjoyed bringing an approved sketch to final? And I know Ollie tweeted about how much she hates it because you said it was like chipping away at a big block of potential to sculpt something passable. And that reminded me of Francis Ford Coppola, I think, talked about how he never was satisfied. But if he could get something 30% out, that was what was in his head into the finished like film he was making, then he's cool with it because that's the best he could do. So I want to ask both of you, are you ever 100% happy with anything you do?
That's such a loaded question because like sometimes I really am, but it's never the things that other people like, you know, like some,
yeah,
you know, it's cool for Francis Ford Coppola to be like, oh, you know, like my brilliant masterpiece is only 30% as good as it could have been. Whereas I'm like, this is 100% as good as it could have been, but nobody gives a shit.
Yeah. I'm the same. The stuff that I like the most of mine, I feel other people aren't as into. But then there's certain pieces that I've done that I did years ago that I'm like, I don't think I could do this again. I think it was very good and I'll never be better than this.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I updated my website this week, which is a painful experience because you have to look at all your old work.
Yeah.
But there's like, I go through stages where I can look at it and be like, yeah, some of this is actually pretty good. And I'm like proud of this. And some of it, I'm like, oh my God, what was I thinking? But, it just depends on the piece and in what mood I'm in and how I'm feeling at the time.
I think that stuff's really important too. Like, I keep folders of old work and I keep them by date, so I can just like go through and look at what was I doing in like 2011, and that's pretty embarrassing. But sometimes they'll be like, it's like really uplifting. It's like, okay, well, I have improved, because sometimes I feel like I'm stagnating or getting worse.
Right, exactly.
But I do feel there's certain pieces that I look at and I feel satisfied by, and they're usually ones where like I tried something different and I really put a lot of effort into learning a new skill set and it ended up paying off somehow. Like, yeah, maybe not exactly how I expected, but it did. I did feel like it added something and that I've learned something. Those are usually the ones that make me feel like, okay, like, I'm progressing. Like, I feel like I'm being productive. Yeah,
I totally agree with that. And I think it's one of the reasons that I tend to try a lot of new media and like new styles in my work, is that it kind of staves off that feeling of skill atrophy. Because if you're not actively trying to just improve the same core set over again, if you're trying to like do new stuff, then you don't feel like you're getting worse. You're just getting different, which is a nice feeling, I think.
So, Ollie, I have a question for you about that, because I am the same. I'm constantly like kind of getting bored of the way I do stuff and being like, I'm going to learn a new thing. But then I also get a little worried that like I come across as being all over the place. So like, right, I'll make like right now, you know, I'm experimenting with a little bit more realism, kind of more like, I'd say like illustrative realism. Mm-hmm. But in the past I was super stylized, and like sometimes I'll go back to that. And like, it just, I feel sometimes like I throw people off with my, like, it's never affected me. Like, I've been able to get jobs and no one's ever commented on it. But I like, as an artist, I'll sometimes look at these really consistent artists and be like, why am I a mess?
All right. So what was your actual question? Is like, how do I feel about that?
How do you deal with that?
Okay. Well, I think the main thing with me is that I've never considered the actual visual side of the work that I produce to be the style. Like, I've always considered the approach and the attitude in the creation to be the like cohesive through line through my work. So a lot of the time, like, I remember a comment that I get a lot is people say like, oh, I've seen all of these, but I didn't know it was the same guy doing it. But when you think about it, it's like, it's clear that it was, it's like the approach to the problem solving that's the style rather than the actual visual thing. Cause I like borrow a visual style from anywhere. I don't like give a shit about that. Anything that kind of gets the job done, like the sells the concept, and I try to have the concept be the thing that I want people to recognize. I mean, there are definitely like techniques that I fall back on. I was going through my portfolio, like I said, this week, adding new stuff, and it's like, oh, a lot of my shit is just an image in the center of a poster. Like, like the composition tends to be like bold and striking, and I try to make it read as a tiny thumbnail. A lot of the time I'll be working on something and be like, oh, this detail is really cool, and I'll zoom out and the canvas just looks like a big mess. Like, it doesn't look like anything. Like, it needs to be readable as like a 200 pixel thumbnail for me to be like happy with it. I think
my new thing, and it's does bad, is I want it to look good on Twitter. Like, I want like the crop to look decent.
Oh, the crop is so frustrating. Ugh, I hate it.
I know, because sometimes it's like, I did a sketch recently and it was like a quick sketch and the crop was just this girl's butt. And I was like, oh, no. Whoops. I didn't mean to.
Yeah, that's the fucking worst. I hate that shit so much. I wish, like, oh god, I hate to just like derail this conversation, but why isn't there a preview for image tweets? Like,
I don't know.
Anyway.
They're focusing on all the wrong shit at that dreaded website.
Yeah, also, why are the Nazis there? Anyway, let's leave that.
But Alex, you joke about the cropping, but like, that is important, especially for like artists starting out, because that's how you show off your image, because people don't click on things often enough.
No, they don't. They will not click links. So if you're sharing from Instagram, share the image. Don't share the link, because no one's going to do that.
No one's got time to click on a link.
No one's got time to click on a link, especially like you're just browsing on your phone on like the toilet or wherever you do that. Like, you're just gonna, you know, you're just swiping through. It has to have it's gotta be a good image. You gotta like see what it's about to want to like click it and make it bigger.
Yeah. And then the other question I wanted to double back on from like 20 minutes ago is when Alex, you were talking about the dissonance between working at Naughty Dog, working on your children's books. And I imagine that dissonance is refreshing, right? Because it's so different from your work in games that You're able to engage other parts of your brain that you wouldn't normally engage with.
It is, yeah. And this has been a thing for me. Like, I guess I'm just the type of person, I did UI and I still love UI. And UI to me is so different from illustration. Like, it's just a different part of my brain that I end up using, or just a different way of thinking. And it's the same with children's books. Like, it's still illustration, so there's that similarity, but it's like just something completely different, like starting new whenever I come back home and can put myself into a different mindset to work on it. I will say that, like, I wish that I'm starting to get better at scheduling myself, so I'm not taking on too much of them at the same time, because right now I only have one of them and it feels really nice to come home and work on it. But when I have too many, then it's just like a chore and it's like, oh, what did I do this for?
For the kids.
For the kids. It is nice, actually. I had my very first, like, one of my coworkers, Josh Scher, I gave him a bunch of, you guys know him, I think, right?
Yeah, I do know him.
Yeah,
he's awesome. Guest on the show.
Oh, yeah, he's awesome. So I gave him, like, a couple copies of the books that I did, and his daughter wrote me a thank you note, and I was like, that's actually the best thing ever.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it is nice working on kids' stuff. It's so rewarding.
One of my favorite things about Double Fine was they have a wall of just all the letters that kids and, like, fans write them, where they keep updating and putting more and more stuff on the wall, and it's the most enlightening and energizing thing you could get working there.
It really is. That stuff is so nice. I love reading stuff like that. Like, some dev posted recently. Oh, no, the... Did you guys see the new Spider-Man trailer? It looks so good.
Yeah.
Oh, the animated Spider-Man one?
Yeah.
Yeah, that stuff looks great.
Someone already wrote, like, a little thank you note about it, and then Coco's been getting a lot of thank you notes that have been shared, and it's so... Like, I cry every time I read them. I'm like, oh, this is so lovely!
Sorry, I'm looking at my question list.
I derail this conversation just nonstop. I'm a derailer.
No, that's good.
No, we're so happy with this.
I think we're like, yeah, I don't know. I think we're doing an equally good job.
It's like all your derails too, like, are going through topics that I wanted to talk about anyway. So I'm just like crossing stuff out as you're talking about these things. Yeah.
Thanks.
And okay, Alex, I have a question for you specifically.
Yeah.
So with UI, you're designing primarily for usability, but you're also trying to match the constraints imposed by the story. Can you talk about balancing that? And I know you'd put out an article during the first Last of Us about how you designed the UI for, like, switching out your backpack and pulling out weapons. And you had said about how one of your earlier systems you were, like, throwing away because the amount of frustration you got from it outweighed any real believability you may have gotten from this, it may have given the story. So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like, it's the first, so I just recently hired a new UI designer artist. She's amazing. Her name's Maria. But during that whole process of hiring, we had so many people who wanted to do that. They wanted to make it feel like you're actually, like, opening the backpack because they felt that that lended something to the narrative. And I get that thinking. I think that is the first instinct is like, oh, I want this to feel so, like, part of the story. But you have to think about it that, like, the user is going to open that backpack not once or twice. They're going to open it hundreds and hundreds of times during the gameplay. And so that's the balance, is like, if I see this once, it's cool. If I see it 10 times, it's starting to get tired. If I see it 100 times, it's really annoying and it's getting in my way. And it does the opposite, where, like, you think that it's lending to the narrative because on the surface it seems like it is, but what it's doing is it's pulling people out every single time because they're seeing this repeated motion, like, over and over and over again. And so for me, I think that it's more important to, like, make the UI really kind of play a background role. Like, you shouldn't really be paying attention to it at all. Like, it should be there because it has to be there because it's guiding you and, you know, giving you the information you need. But I think attempts that for the games that we make, because I've seen it work in other games, but for specifically the games that I've worked on, those attempts have tended to make things feel clunky. Not saying that there's not a way to do it, because I think there probably is, but this is just based on, like, experiences that I've had with it, is, like, it better serves the narrative to kind of let the UI, like, really kind of hold back and not get in the way and not try to contribute to it.
And my follow-up question for this was, how do you convey tone through UI?
That one, I mean, I guess, like, for me now in this, the current way things are, I try to keep the UI really, really minimal and really simple. I don't try to, like, make it match the aesthetic or anything like that of the game, because I tend to think that that also pulls things out. Like, our games span so many different environments, so many different color palettes, and like a UI that looks like really good and like kind of on tone in one area isn't going to in another area necessarily.
Right. We had that problem specifically with like big colorful UI in Firewatch, where I was trying to color grade every scene and make it look as good as it could, and then there's this big like flashing yellow light in the corner. You're like, oh fuck off, it's ruining the whole thing. But
yeah. And when you need to pay attention to it, then it should be using those things. Like, right, sometimes exactly. You need to pay attention to the UI. But like as a whole, it's a very subtle line. Like I do want it to feel like it fits the world. Some shapes just tend to feel a little bit, you know, like too techy or too, I don't know, like modern or something like that. And those can stand out in a negative way. So it's more like towing the line of like, yeah, I want it to give the overall impression, but I don't want it to have some sort of like tactile quality that is like, this is definitely like a piece of paper in The Last of Us. Like,
but there's no sort of hard and fast rule with that stuff, because I was just, as you were going through that, I was thinking, yes, 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 I agree with everything you're saying. But then I thought about a game that has a really sort of in-world crazy UI design that like really elevates the experience, which is like the original Dead Space, where it's like having that stuff on the character and exist in-world was so good, and just like it enhanced the experience, and like having a clunky-ish UI actually improved this kind of feeling, like the tension in that game of like of having to find a safe space to actually go into your stuff was really cool.
Yeah, and Dead Space is often used as an example of diegetic UI that people want to mimic. But what's important to note about Dead Space is it was a sci-fi type of game. And so I think that there are examples of other games that have used diegetic UI that have had some level of success. Like, I think it was Far Cry was in Africa. I think it was number two.
Yeah.
So I think in that one, he like pulls his gun up and like opens it to see how many bullets are in it. And he like looks at his watch and stuff like that. And so, I mean, some people really enjoy that level of like immersion, like where the UI is like really paired with the gameplay. But for what we were working on anyway, it just didn't work. I love Dead Space. I think for like sci-fi style games, it's like perfect.
Yeah. Or like, even if you're making
UI.
A sort of like Far Cry 2, like this sort of open world systemic thing, I think, you know, as long as it's not crushing your story beats, it's probably fine. Actually, having said that, like I hate diegetic UI. I say UI, but like, I guess title cards in films. I hate it so much. Like ever since Panic Room had those fucking 3D title, like things, and then it was in Fringe and everything else. Oh, that is the worst. It completely draws me out of it every time those things come on screen. I hate them. I hate them, I hate them, I hate them.
Yeah, it's like, I guess it's just the way that I am. It's like my aesthetics tend to be more, I like really minimal things. So like UIs that I like recently, I always feel like Destiny did pretty good at it. Like it's very simple and streamlined and clean. And like, I really liked Battlefield, the World War, the World War One.
Yeah.
Yeah, because that was an example of a very clean, streamlined UI that didn't feel techie, because most of the time people's response will be like, it feels too sci-fi if it's clean. But it doesn't. That they picked fonts that matched that, you know, time period, and like they did things that I felt made it feel integrated and didn't pull me out of it. Yeah,
I think those DICE games will do a really good job of that. And I'm glad that you pointed out Destiny as well, because I think that game is really, really smart with its UI, not just in the sense of it looking simple, but like the decision to let you move a cursor with a controller must have been like pretty hard to get through. I don't know, like I think the guy that pitched that probably maybe had a hard time doing that, because it feels so counterintuitive, but it's such a good solution to the specific problems that game poses.
Yeah, and I think that's actually going back to the very first question. That's an example of, I mean, I can just assume that whoever did that had to go to someone and be like, hey, this is not like other games, but I really want to try it.
Right, exactly.
And had to go through the whole process of like convincing people that it was worthwhile and all that stuff. So I think the cursor really works for that game. One thing that I hope doesn't happen is that other people just start doing it just because they did it, because I think that it fits that game particularly, but it might not fit every game. But I was happy to see that they did. I think their UI is one of my favorite UIs that I've seen. So I really enjoy that game and their UI work.
it's crazy how much it's gone, like how much UI has changed and design over like the last 10 or 15 years. Because I could totally see an earlier version of Uncharted being like the health bar is like a gun in the corner of like just leather across the screen.
It was leather, yeah. There was like a leather texture. It was, I mean, that was what it was back then. It's nothing against Uncharted.
That's what it was. I was thinking.
Yeah. But I also,
no, yeah.
But I also secretly love that a lot of Japanese games like aggressively just keep UIs in like the SNES era. And it's like you load up the game and it's just in the middle of the screen. It's like ding, 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 ding every time you're like going through the stuff. I love it so much.
Yeah. And I mean, some people really still like that. So like Persona to me is a very like styled, like heavy styled UI, Persona 5. Right. And people like cosplay as that UI. Like, yeah, people
the UI
still like that.
But the UI actually in Persona 5 is basically the UI from Final Fantasy 7, just with like layers and layers and layers of style on top of it. It's still a very like, I don't want to say like unconsidered because it works for that game, but it's, but it's, you know what I mean? It's still like, it's still, you're just going through menus and saying yes, no, and dive. Layers and layers and layers of like text boxes.
Yeah, I haven't played it, so I can't. I have to play games for me to judge the UI, even for a second. Right. Like sometimes I'll look at it and be like, "Oh, I don't understand what's happening," but then I play it and I'm like, "Actually, this is pretty intuitive." Like,
right.
There's a lot of UI in Horizon, but I actually feel like for the most part it works really well, and I can always tell what's happening, and I never feel frustrated by it. So it's like, but if I were to just see screenshots of a game with a lot of UI, I'm probably gonna be like, "Whoa, that's a lot of stuff. A lot of stuff happening there." But they also provide good options to like turn things off and on and to customize your experience. So I find that really cool.
I think the reason why people like Persona 5's UI so much too is because, and you can't get it across in images, is that the transitions between different UI elements is amazing and is really seamless and makes you feel a sense of propulsion like constantly, instead of breaking things up where UI screen then just disappears, then you go back to gameplay and so on, but everything morphs into everything else.
Yeah, I really need to try it because it's like one of those like rare, like Dead Space was one, Destiny was one, and then this is another one where people really focus on how much they like the UI, which is very rare. Like normally people don't talk about it at all, or if they don't like it, then they talk about it a lot. But yeah. I do need to sit down and play this game because it's gotten such positive feedback for that.
And as you were saying, like how UI builds to tone, I think that like Persona is so much a game about UI, like this cool teen, you know, and the world is at your feet and you can do whatever you want. And like all the options are open to you. And just having a very, very like, trendy is such a terrible word, but like a very stylized, beautiful, and like sort of like aggressively in your face UI really helps that somehow. It just sells the tone of that game so well.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I can see that it looks very trendy. Like it looks very it looks cool. Like,
God,
it looks
we're
like
so
cool
old. We're
internet
so old.
Kids.
We're old
I know,
now.
We just like,
oh,
we just
so
like
trendy.
It looks like hip youngsters.
Yeah.
It looks like a it looks like one of those memes I don't understand.
Hello, fellow kids. Very Bitcoin.
Yeah. Have you heard about the blockchain and the Persona 5?
No.
I can't think of another word that would work better than trendy, though. That wouldn't sound worse. Like, trendy fits for
God.
That, though.
It looks lit.
Yeah, you didn't think.
Wait, Alex, quick question. How would you design the UI for a Harry Potter game?
Oh, my God.
Have you thought about that?
Yes, I think about it every day. I think about it every day. I think about, like, a Harry Potter World of Warcraft mashup, like, every single day of my life. But I don't, that one's hard for me. That one's hard because I don't think I would hate a tactile UI in Harry Potter just because it is so like, it is what it is. Like it's,
yeah,
it's Harry Potter. That would be very thematic. Like, I don't know what I would feel about minimalism in Harry Potter.
Right. Because, well, it's really funny to me because the UI of like, I say the UI, but like the graphic design of the Harry Potter universe didn't really solidify until the third movie.
Yeah.
Where they basically went to a London design studio called Mina Lima, who are very, very, very good, and were like, can you design this for us? And they basically just picked, I mean, it's a very good solution to the problem, but they picked what was trendy at the time, which was big fucking crazy letterpress shit. And then that just became the Harry Potter aesthetic, which is, it's so weird that they managed to get away with that, which was like, take the trendy aesthetic at the time and like transplant it into a magical world full of wizards and say that this is like the thing that wizards are into. Just like big letterpress newspapers, apparently, is the thing that they like.
It worked.
It's like, it was a fucking stroke of genius. And all of the actual production design in those things is like so good. And they managed to like transform a really popular aesthetic into something that felt like particularly Harry Potter. And also unlike anything that had been in that universe before, because the first two movies are so basic in their stylization. It was only the third one that really introduced some extra kind of, I guess, like something unique into it. Yeah, personality, I think, is a good way. Because, I mean, the first two are like Chris Columbus, right? Just fucking sleepwalking it. I don't know.
But he's just adapting it. He's not like doing anything new with it.
Right, exactly.
He should be given credit for like he cast those movies incredibly well. Like that's all Chris Columbus.
No, he did. But I also think that like some of the character design and stylization from the Alphonse Cuarón one is like way more outrageously cartoony than other things that appeared later. Like the Emma Thompson character, the Professor Trelawney, is like just so cartoonish and ridiculous.
Yeah. And it took Cuarón to finally say, like, hey, maybe they don't need to wear their school uniforms all the time.
Oh, yeah. They just stopped one day. They just, were like, we're going to wear clothes now.
But I was like, where does Harry get that hoodie from? He would never have something like that. He'd have a big, like, I was being a weird, bad traditionalist.
You want to talk about, like, oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
No, like, the most, like, dream job I think I could possibly imagine is working on, I mean, they're not going to do this, but if they did, like, a Harry Potter show, like, if they took the whole story and just, like, did, like, an HBO show with
That's my dream. I want that.
That's my dream. Yes, and I want to do, like just world-building stuff. Like, I want to, like, work on little items and things in that world. Like, I just want to be in it for my whole life.
HBO, if you're listening, hire these two people for this.
Oh man, please do it. You're doing Lord of the Rings. One of
when
you
Game
is.
Of Thrones ends. Amazon is. Yeah,
Amazon's doing Lord of the Rings.
Did you? Like, okay. Amazon paid $200 million just for the rights to Lord of the Rings before they even shot. Like they haven't done anything. They just pay for the rights.
Guys. Tom Bombadil TV show. That's all I'm saying. That's all I want.
No. Yeah. Yes. See. Yeah. No. This is why. About. Wait a second. We need to talk about this. I'm sorry to derail. You don't actually love Tom Bombadil, do you?
Who doesn't love Tom Bombadil? He's the fucking
I best. Hate Tom Bombadil. I have never been able to read those books because I get to the Tom Bombadil part and I go, this is the most boring shit I've ever read. Like, yep.
It's really bad. I that was a roadblock for me when I was a kid as well, like reading through that bit. And then you get through it and it gets really, really bleak and sad. And you're just like, I pine for the days of Tom Bombadil. I want to go back to that. Amazing forest with
they're
his
creepy
crazy
his river wife his she river watches wife. Them bathe they bathe and she's like oh old Tom Bombadil's
have
river
you read
wife
that book?
Watches
they do,
the hobbits bathe
they do a lot of bathing and singing in those books
like and eating
they do.
Yeah it's too much I regret it. I feel like I would probably love it it's like established everything I love but I just can't get past Tom I should skip Tom Bombadil am I like missing anything if I skip it
oh you're missing all the great Tom Bombadil bits
some songs.
No, I can't read songs. Here's the thing: I can't read songs. Like when people write out songs in books, I'm like, I'm not. I hope this isn't important.
Yeah, I skip it every time. What I really should do is just pick it. What I should do is just pick a tune that I read them to in my head for every song. Like if you read them all to the tune of like the Final Countdown or Danger Zone or something, it would be fucking amazing.
Actually, yeah, that would be good. I listened to an audiobook recently where there was a woman singing a song, and the older gentleman reading the book sang it and I had to throw my headphones off of my ears and like run into the other room and just like shudder at how much I hated it.
Oh, it's so good. I love it when that happens. And I love it when it's so clear that they're just sort of making the melody up as they go along. It's good.
Yes.
It's
so cringy.
Okay. The answer to Max's question is you do it like Dead Space where Harry pulls out his wand and then the UI comes out of it and he just makes sparks for whatever menu.
And he says like expecto user experience and
control
then, like something will, a beautiful ethereal magic effect will fly out of his wand and then he will just pick things.
You need to like say spells to make stuff happen. Like you have a microphone and you need to like learn the spells of the UI.
And you have a stop button.
You all hate my UI. I'm the worst UI designer.
Okay. I have a question for Ollie.
Sure.
In an interview talking about Firewatch, you said,
It's easy to frame a shot for a photo or illustration, but it's far harder to create a space where the player is going to naturally frame the shot well themselves. They have to keep it feeling like a wild, natural place and not somewhere that has been meticulously designed.
Well, that's specific to Firewatch, but yeah.
Well, yeah, I wanted to hear, how do you go about doing that? How did you go about doing that?
I mean, you just have to create spaces where the player kind of... In the case of Firewatch, it was about creating spaces for which, the entrance gave people the best possible chance, frame a good shot. So, Firewatch is, is a pretty linear game. You're walking along a path, and there are big sort of open areas where you can get off the path a little bit, but mostly you know which direction you're going to be going in, and you're just walking in that direction. So it's about, placing things, if a player turns a corner, they're going to see, there's a 70% chance they're going to be looking in the right direction and you place the things there. Or if a zone has two or three different ways of getting to it, then you just make sure that it looks good from each of those zones. It's just about manicuring a space. It's like landscape architecture. You just make sure that there's something there's more likely to be something. I say that, and you go to a demo station, and you watch someone walking around and looking at the floor the whole time, and you're like, "Fuck you!" I hate you. You just got to make it so that people have the best possible chance of doing it, and that means looking at it yourself from as many angles as possible and making sure it holds up to scrutiny. There's always going to be your preferred way of experiencing a thing that you've made, but not everyone is going to do it that way, and in fact, most people probably won't. So, just make sure that people have a chance to see something good.
Makes sense. And along those same lines, you also said nothing compromises your vision more than someone getting lost and bored in your game. Like you just talked about now about a person looking at the floor.
Right.
Knowing how to draw the player's eye and make them go down paths that you want them to without feeling like they're being led is really important.
Yeah.
How do you thread the needle between being too obtuse and too explicit?
Man, I definitely used to be a person that hated that in games when I felt like I was being led. I was like, oh, just give me a give gamers a chance. Gamers are smart. They'll be able to figure this out. They won't. No, you need to signpost shit really, really, really obviously. And you can make it, you can try and get around it as much as possible by making a space that maybe feels a little real, but mostly your lighting design is going to direct people roughly in the right direction. Just walk towards the brightest light usually is a thing that you learn as a person who plays single player games. Honestly, it's stupid, but it's something that you have to do because it's the feeling of being led, as annoying as it is so much better than the feeling of not knowing where you're going. That's boring and frustrating. And if you train your players early to look for really subtle clues and not huge ones, I think The Last of Us does it really well because it just uses yellow on stuff, right, Alex? Just yellow is the come here color, on the edge of things, a ladder or something will be yellow.
Yeah, it was either paint or caution tape or something.
Yeah,
there's a bunch of different yellow things.
Yeah, and it doesn't explicitly tell you hey guys, go to the yellow stuff. That's where you gotta go. But it works in that game because you it sort of ingrains it in you and trains you in a really subtle way to look for that stuff.
Yeah, I think those anchors, you see them and you know, I'm pretty sure that's where I'm supposed to go. So then you feel more confident in, exploring. I know that's the way, but I'm going to, look around and I'm not lost. I'm just, looking for shit now.
Right, that's a really good point. It's when you know the next space that you have to go to, it gives you so much more confidence to, go off the path and be I can come back to this in a minute.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because otherwise you're just wandering around am I supposed to go here? And you just start to feel more frustrated. And then by the time you do find the thing where you're supposed to go, you don't want to explore anymore. You just want to go because you're well, I'm angry now.
All right. I have more general questions, but I have a specific one to Alex first.
Yes.
Alex, you created 33 pages of Drake's Journal for Uncharted 4.
Yes.
What was that process like? Because I laughed so hard when you did the drawing of what the feeling is of sticking your hand in that hole.
Oh, yeah, it's so good. That journal is so beautiful. And, when I saw it, I was like, oh, Alex did this. I can totally tell when I was going through
it.
Yeah, it's amazing.
You guys, that's so nice. That was done very late in production. And those pickups and stuff sort of get left towards the end. And then Neil or Bruce or one of them came to me and was like, do you want to do the journal? And I was like, okay, sure. And they're like, we need to have it done very quickly. And I was like, let's do it. And so I worked with Josh Scher, who wrote a lot of the, he like kind of laid out where we were going to find stuff and what it was going to be about. But then he sort of gave me freedom. Like, he gave me tips on what to do, but he also gave me freedom to come up with whatever I wanted it to be. And so we'd work together on getting, you know, kind of a first pass, send it over to Neil and Bruce. And it was actually like pretty stress free, even though it got done really quickly. And it was so fun. And it was like such a night, like, you know, those games are why I wanted to work at Naughty Dog, and the journal is a big part of him. So it felt really cool to be like, I'm the last, like, Nathan Drake Uncharted's handwriting. Like, that's kind of cool.
Actually, yeah, I have a question about that. Like, when you do the handwriting stuff in the studio, do you just like, hey, who's got handwriting that's who's this? Like, so your handwriting is the Nathan Drake handwriting.
Nate's handwriting is mine, but slightly altered, and how I do that. So I also handwrote, I think 30 something pirate notes, and they had to all have different handwriting.
Oh no, that's awful.
So what I would do is I would use a base font, and then I would like lower the opacity and trace
that's
the
really
font
smart.
In a way. Yeah, but I would like make it so that it was handwriting, obviously. Not like a font.
No, like,
but that would give me
perfectly lined out. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, that would give me different letter forms, and then I would like sometimes just make like I would learn the font over time, and then I'd be able to like make the words like kind of look so uneven.
Oh, that's awesome. That's so fascinating. We just did it where we doled out roles in the studio. We just like, who's got the worst handwriting? And it turned out to be me. So I was like the 13-year-old child. And it's just like my actual handwriting in the game. I didn't edit it at all. It's just like terrible.
Well, Nate's is mine, but I took my Cintiq, and you know how you can like rotate it? I kind of rotated it so that it gave the opposite slant of how my handwriting slants.
Oh, okay.
So I would always like rotate my Cintiq so that it just was a little different than my handwriting. But yeah, it was, that part was the first one that I did. I redid it, and it was for one of the trailers. I redid it, I think, 10 times, the pirate note, because we just couldn't, like, it just felt weird, and like it wasn't legible enough, and I don't know, that we're very detail oriented. Like, so many people don't look at that stuff, but like, yeah, I rewrote those letters like quite a bit to get them to feel good.
I don't know, when I'm playing like a video game and I pick up a letter and it's obviously like just a straight up typeface, it just takes me right out of it. I fucking hate it.
Yeah,
it does.
And I know why they do it, and it's just for like localization issues.
Mm-hmm.
It's like so much easier to localize that stuff if it's just a like font projected onto a thing. But I don't know. We had a big argument about this, actually. Like, well, the programmers were like, well, we have to just have everything be fonts. And I was like, no, stop being stupid. We're not doing that. It's terrible.
Yeah, and I mean, how we get around that is you press a button and the screen kind of blacks out and you get the actual.
Yeah,
so, because some people don't want to read scrawly handwriting either. Like, that's also kind of hard to.
Yeah, you have to have that because, like,
some people have tiny TVs.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, so it pops up and you can read it in a font. That's how we get around doing those things. But overall, that was one of my favorite parts of working on Uncharted. It was very quick, and I loved that I was able to do that.
Did it sort of give you like a nice little like stylistic escape from the main stuff you were doing?
Yeah, well, at the time I was doing crunching on the UI. Like, it was getting all the UI for MP and single player.
I forgot that you did the multiplayer stuff as well.
Yeah. So it was just this like night. It was very nice for me to work on that. It was a nice kind of send off for me of Uncharted.
Right. That's how I felt about like the printed stuff in Firewatch. It was just like, oh, this is getting too much. I'm going to design another book cover and just like put that in the game.
Yeah, I like doing that too, where I have like kind of a couple things to work on at a time. So like that was sort of being balanced between making sure the UI was like, you know, in the place that we needed it to be. So like when I was really stressed out about UI, I'd be like, it's the end of the day, I'm going to write a pirate note. Let's find a good pirate font and trace it.
Speaking of stress, this is like a more general question, but we talk about with writers and narrative designers to come on here, we talk about assumptions that people make about our jobs. I want to hear, what are some of the biggest assumptions people make about your work that are just wrong or that drive you crazy?
You get to do what you love all day. Your job must be great.
Yeah, that one.
Yeah, I mean, that's basically it, right? I mean, I love my job. It's great. And there is a sense that, I get to sit around and like listen to audiobooks and just draw shit all day. But the main thing that people don't get with that is, you know, you take what you do, you know, the saying like do what you love. It's like, do what you love forever to the point that you can't like distinguish between your job and the thing that you like doing the most, the thing that you love doing the most is now like forever associated with being at work and money it has the potential to like corrupt the thing that you like doing the most in the world, and like you don't take
it. Yeah.
And if you're not careful and you don't take care of yourself, it can really like leave you with nothing that you actually like doing. That's an issue.
Yeah, I'm the same. I have to, when I'm at home and I want to paint, I usually do it traditionally now because it separates it, because I need the separation. Otherwise, I just feel like I'm burning myself out and that I need to save that energy. And for some reason, traditional feels so new and fresh to me because I learned digitally on those forums that it's like a way for me to feel like I can keep doing the thing I love, but it's separate and I won't do that thing for pay. Like, it's just what I do. But another one for me is that people have really weird ideas of what concept art or production art even is, that it's just like sitting around painting your feelings or like painting a very good technical painting. Right. And I think that a lot of people, I got a couple people sort of seemingly agitated at me, like fans, that I was able to do concept art for Naughty Dog, even though my work wasn't realistic, because they believed, I think they felt that I was taking something from them because they'd been working on doing realistic work and thought that's what it took. And then I was doing non-realistic work. And it's like, well, you just don't understand. This isn't just like sitting around painting the type of work that you see out there, like the marketing art or anything like that. That's not about.
And that's something that comes about, where people use concept art and PR, like, oh, look at this sick concept art that's released. And then people just think that that's like the entirety of what the job is, which it isn't at all.
No, yeah, it's so much more than that. And it's very rarely just sitting around painting super beautiful marketing art. I don't know if it's ever been sitting around painting super beautiful marketing art for me. But yeah, there's a lot of like facets to doing any team.
Yeah, I would say that for me on Firewatch, that was probably like 5% of my role. In the art, was like doing the art that you actually like, the concept art that came out of that production, like it's probably like 5% of the entire thing. Especially on sorry, carry on.
No, go ahead.
Oh, I was gonna say, especially because it was like, at least for us, we had it a little different. Our situation was a little different from yours because we were such a small team. That like I ended up having to like light the whole game by myself, basically.
That's very cool.
Which is cool. Like, I'm glad it was a crazy learning process. And they were just like, oh, like it's better if you just go and do all the environmental like tuning yourself. So, and I like had to place all the logic triggers in the world. So like, it was just, yeah, it was on a small team. Like everybody has to pull their weight and just do things they're not comfortable with, I guess. And I liked it. It was a really cool experience. And, I definitely learned so much on that project.
Yeah, it's similar with us. We do. I mean,
you're a small team for the scale of the games you make. You're a very small team.
Yeah, and I mean, with UI stuff, like I came on, to do UI art and design. I ended up doing like all sorts of marketing art and all sorts of. I mean, now I do concept, but that started as a trickle. Like it started as Neil being like, "I like your work. Can you try doing these things?" And that took like 4-5 years to get to the point where now I'm like switching out completely. And that was my choice. They would have had me, I'm sure they would love if I just like continued to do both, because that's sort of, what they like. But that's really common in our studio that people will, there's stuff that you'll be tasked with that it's like, this isn't necessarily, I don't know whose department it is. I don't think it's mine, but you just do it. Like you kind of learn new things and you try to contribute as much as you can. But even just like someone who just does pure concept art, like it's never what people think it is on the outside. Like it's never just sitting there painting paintings. It's often like finding reference and like we already talked about doing scanning and like Ashley Swadowski, my lead, like set up an entire pipeline for that on Uncharted. And she's like the most amazing friggin' painter and super amazing at just like doing that part of it. Establishing pipelines. Like that's not a thing that people think about when they think of doing concept art, I don't think.
No, right, no. Exactly.
Alex, do people have assumptions about UI?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people think what I do is just icons, like, not in my studio. People in the studio know what I do, but people on the outside are like, oh, you do the icons. And it's like, well, and a lot of people too, and I think I'm a very bad example, people think that it's like some sort of gateway into concept, but it's really not anymore. Like, what I look for in UI designers is like really strong graphic design knowledge, really strong kind of, it's more game design sort of, really, because that's where it starts to cross into, because you are working with designers more than anything to like design the experience and design like, you know, what people are seeing to help kind of feed them through the game.
Right. In fact,
yeah, that's a big one.
It's actually really interesting that you say it's more like game design. I think that's probably true for any role in game development, that the best people tend to be the ones that understand something's role within a game rather than just their own specialized like take on it. Mm-hmm. Right, like concept artists who can understand like what it's like to inhabit an environment, and like we were talking about earlier, people who, you know, who are going to understand like, all right, so this is how someone will enter an environment, this is what they'll experience when they're in it, and then it'll look like this when they leave. Like that, you need to understand the way like players play the game.
Yeah, and you need to know your role in that, because you're not just a person sitting there doing your thing. Like, you're very, like, UI is a weird bridge department where I was working with programmers, designers. Mm. Sometimes VFX, like, you're just working with all of these different people trying to learn, like, okay, like, how do they do their thing? How do I fit into this? So yeah, it's a lot. UI maybe is the most, in my experience, so many people don't understand what I do. I have to explain constantly what I do, and then they still are like, this is like Bitcoin, like, I don't get this.
This is a more general question for both of you. What's the art direction that's exciting you these days?
Oh, God.
Campo's new game.
Sorry?
The Campo's new game Santa's that Campo just...
oh, yeah, the game, the Valley of...
Valley of Gods.
I did it. In the Valley of Gods, I keep... Like, I said to Jake, like, you're going to have to be pedantic about people not calling it the Valley of the Gods, and I just fucking did it. Yeah, that game looks outrageous. I'm getting major FOMO from looking at it and being like, fuck, they're doing such a good job. But, like, Claire is killing... Claire Hummel, the concept artist on that game, basically, my old role in that studio is fucking murdering it. It's so good. It looks incredible. They've made so many good choices, and I think there's a good chance that I might do a little bit more work on that game, maybe. A teeny bit, just like helping out, because, you know, again, it's still like coming from that studio. There's like a really, really good team of people who think very, very carefully about marketing and like visual design and all that stuff, and it all comes together really, really well. But at the end of the day, it is a 12-person studio or something. So, like, So I might jump on and give him a hand at some point. I actually did a teeny bit of work on that trailer, weirdly.
Oh, yeah, I saw Lisa on Twitter. You did, like, some of the titling.
Yeah, stuff. I did some of the title stuff, but, yeah. It's, that game looks cool. I actually really don't know much about it, other than it looks amazing.
Yeah, and that
great music.
Yeah, the whole thing was just like, oh, I love what they're doing there. And then this is so silly, maybe, because it's not really about the art direction, but I just am so pumped that the guy that made Stardew Valley is making a wizard game.
Oh, is he making a wizard game?
He's making a wizard school game.
Oh, crazy!
Oh my God.
Yeah, I gotta look it up.
I'm game jamming on a wizard game right now. Weirdly.
Oh, look up. It's Chucklefish, I think, is the name of this.
Yeah, that's
studio.
Yeah. Is it like a Stardew Valley style wizard game?
Yeah.
Oh my God, that's going to be incredible.
So those are my two like anticipated games right now, is the Campo one and the, that game's going to take a while though. Wizard game.
For sure.
Yeah.
Speaking of art direction, there's nothing really that's like, that jumps to my mind when you say that. I mean, actually something that I'm playing right now that I love is, the new Assassin's Creed game.
Oh yeah,
it's really good. It's like surprisingly amazing, and it is gorgeous. I got the fancy new Xbox and on my fancy TV, and it looks just unbelievable. Like, I can't believe how good that game looks a lot of the time. It's incredible.
I want to play it.
Yeah, John plays it, and I just want him to unlock the one where you get to just go around and tour. I want to do the tourism mode.
It's not out yet.
Yeah, it's not. Yeah,
I'm so excited that they're doing
it. The game is already kind of like, it's, there's something about those Ubisoft, like those big Ubisoft open world games that feel so low impact for me in terms of how much attention I feel I need to give them, that I will just put on a podcast and play that game and not really listen to the cutscenes or care about.
As you're murdering people?
Well, like, I actually really enjoy the characters in those games, and I don't think the Assassin's Creed series gets enough credit for its mostly good characters in a sort of in the world of mostly bad video game characters.
Mm-hmm.
And I like, and you know, it's they usually have like a good, they have a good and diverse cast of people, and the new game is like probably has one of my favorite protagonists of all of them.
Oh, nice! I didn't know even people were interested in him.
No, he's good. I like him. He's like my favorite since Ezio, I think, who I really really liked, but whatever.
Awesome.
I already mentioned it, but Horizon Zero Dawn is really beautiful. And yep. What I really like about it is there's so much talk all the time about how open worlds are hard to keep a narrative going, but they did a really good job with their narrative where, like, it's not like in Red Dead where, like, you had to go, I think you had to go, like, save your kid or something, right? Like, so it always felt really weird when you went off to the side to, like, murder a Yeti family.
Yeah.
this one is, like the events already happen and you're just kind of trying to figure stuff out, like, so I really like how they did that, and it makes it feel like not so like weird. And also the subquests also feel somewhat connected to the thing, like the major story through line.
I kind of fell off that game a little bit because I was playing it and loving it and really really loving it, and then Breath of the Wild came out and it just completely ate my life for a minute. And that's like how I see video games, that's like the kind of video game storytelling that I'm interested in right now, which is just big, open, systemic, not particularly like led design. Like, I think video games are currently in a state where they are more successful at being storytelling engines than actually like telling a story. And that's not to say that I don't like, when a game story like gets me, I love it, but the vast majority of them usually, for me at least, get in the way of the thing that I want from them, which is just to sit and be entertained. And usually the cutscenes and a huge amount of exposition that you're forced to sit through before you start it are just like obstacles to enjoying the thing that you've been sold.
Breath of the Wild, for me, the best parts of that game were completely optional, and it was like there was one shrine in particular where you freed a dragon, and it was like a Miyazaki movie in like a little like 15 minute cut, and I would just love a game that was like that. Like, if it didn't, I didn't dislike the main storyline, but if it was just like exploring and like finding these shrines and these like emergent little story moments, then it would have been
right. Like, I want the Skyrim. Yeah, I want the Skyrim and the Breath of the Wild that doesn't have that, like, you are the chosen one to save the world. I want something that feels like an adventure simulator, that there's like this world of potential out there for you to go and discover, but the order in which you discover it will be entirely your own doing. Like, it's not, you're not led by some grand quest. I love that shit so much, because most good fantasy literature kind of like feels that way. It kind of feels that the things that they get into end up being sort of like weirdly incidental. And the ability to listen, like, craft your own crazy story in that way, I think would be great. Especially because so much of the story that exists in these games actually doesn't really exist. It just exists in the player's imagination. So just giving them like points that they're like, giving them the dots, and they'll like create the connective tissue themselves in their heads is kind of what I'm interested in.
Yeah, it's actually amazing to me to watch. So John and I are very, very different gamers. Like, his favorite games right now are like PUBG, and he's really not into like story stuff at all. He's into like, you know, kind of co-op gaming experiences. But him playing that game is so fascinating because he has dumped considerably more hours than me into it. I beat the whole game and I did all the shrines.
You talking about Breath of the Wild? Not... Sorry, I thought you were talking about.
Yeah,
I thought you were talking about. Sorry, I thought you were talking about PUBG. Still, I was like, he beat all the shrines. What? I've been playing this game wrong.
No, in Breath of the Wild, like, I beat all the shrines, did all the bosses. John has more hours than me. He has not done a single divine beast. He plays the game by like being like, oh, I wonder what's over there, and then he just like gets on his horse, who he loves, and like rides the horse to that area. He will not fast travel. He just like rides the horse to the area and like just kind of like, he's trying to get all the seeds. The Korok seeds. And it's just so amazing that like two gamers that are so completely different can love this game this same? Like, because normally, like, a game that I love, he's not going to – I'm into, like, Bloodborne and stuff like that. He's not really into those. And likewise for him, except for this game and PUBG. Those are, like, the only two games. And they both just allow you to do whatever you want.
And they're really similar. Like, PUBG is, I think, the most amazing storytelling engine.
It's really awesome.
I can't – like, I always come out of, like, a 2 or 3 hour session of that game with – some like laughing really hard that there'll have been some crazy story where somebody did something ridiculous. It's very, very, very good. And I think that's what people want now from video games. I like that it's diverging more from sort of a traditional linear narrative experience. Although like they have the potential to do a really, really good job of those as well.
Yeah, I think it's just nice to have the option, right? Like, because I think there's so many different types of gamers. I think that I'm still the type of gamer that loves to just sit through a narrative experience, like a linear narrative. But I like to have the option in my gaming. Like, I like that we're now doing this thing where it's like, okay, there are going to be games out there that don't have this centralized like narrative. It's more just like do whatever you want. Like, I like seeing that variety. So yeah, that's what's exciting to me is that depending on the mood I'm in, I'll still be able to find a game that I'm interested in playing at any given moment.
Agreed. Do you want to ask one question back? Do you want to end it now?
Okay, to both of you, our last question. What tools in the storytelling toolbox do you feel are overutilized and or underutilized right now in games?
Oh, just like
I just want to hear your perspective on this.
Okay, just like exposition.
People
who are making games who fall in love with their own lore so much that they feel that you need to also understand it before you can enjoy their brilliant masterwork. Like, I hate it so much. I don't need to know everything about your world before jumping into it. I just, like, tell it to me organic. Like, sci-fi and fantasy authors know that, like, the best way to absorb a reader in their world is to just, like, gradually ease them into it in a way that, or like, sort of throw them in a way that they'll piece it together themselves as they go, rather than just being like, and this is what happened here, and this is what this thing means, and oh god, I hate it. Just like an incredible amount of exposition at the beginning of your game. Please don't do it. I hate it. It's the worst.
Yeah, I tend to agree with that. I think that my favorite games, and we kind of just talked about this, are like where I feel like I've discovered something, and maybe I won't. Like, I think having that in, like, having a game made where they know that there's parts of their story that maybe someone's never going to see, but it really feels rewarding for the people that do find it. Like, you feel like you've discovered something, and that's kind of what I want to see more of in game storytelling. Right. Is like boldness, I guess.
And it's hard as a video game maker because everything takes so long to make. And
yes.
It's hard to make that content and then leave it on the shelf, you know, for like maybe 70% of your audience aren't going to see it. It's really, really difficult to do that, but I think it's the right choice.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything that both you'd want to see more in games they don't feel is being done a lot?
In terms of narrative stuff or just anything?
Yeah.
I don't know. That's a really good question. I'd have to think about it. Oh, God, sorry. This is a non-answer. I'd have to think about it.
I'm really excited about like how many like different stories are being told now. Like, Campo has, you know, this woman of color in their game. Two women of color in their game. And like just seeing like that to me just automatically lends more interest. I'm more interested in hearing different people's perspectives and different narratives like that, because then you get less repeat, right? Like, you get less of the like the same old same that games have been plagued by for the past 30 years.
Right, especially because games have a really, really amazing, have a very unique ability to kind of put you, like to force you into the perspective of someone else, and yet they continually put you in the same position over and over and over again. It's very bad. Actually, I really, one thing I'd like to see more of, is, oh God, this is stupid, but I played Wolfenstein 2 really recently. And
yeah, we're playing it right now.
I love the opening section of that game where you play in the wheelchair.
And yeah,
great. And it made me more like, I want to play a whole game of this. Like, I think I really liked that section in particular. Where
it feels different. It's not just like, not necessarily not just lower.
Yeah, not necessarily about playing a person in a wheelchair, but just like the idea of looking at an environment that is traditionally completely normal and you have the ability to trespass it without thought, and then making you think about it differently. I liked that a lot, and I like to see more of that in video games.
You probably just made like anyone listening who's part of the accessibility community so excited, because that's a thing that comes up pretty often is like you rarely see somebody, you know, who's in a wheelchair as a main character or like, you know, people living with disabilities. Like you don't often see them in those hero roles. So that's a thing that working with that community has often come up. Like it'd be, and some websites actually have lists of all the games you can play that do have usually a minor character that's living with a disability. So it's like,
right.
I think it provides like really interesting problems to solve. And like you said, like that's a really interesting gameplay element, like navigating the space and things like that. So that's a thing that like that community would be so excited for.
And I love the way that Wolfenstein does it as well, because it doesn't feel like you're necessarily disempowered. It's just you're thinking about the space in a different way. And I love that about it.
Yeah, I agree. I think that'd be really cool.
That's a good note to end on. So that's it. Where can people find you two on the internet? Ollie, do you want to pimp out your new
website? Yeah, you can find me at http://goth.zone.
Oh my God.
And where can people find you on Twitter too?
Twitter.com/JimDavis. No, Twitter.com/OliMoss.
We'll put them both up in the show notes.
Yep, good. I don't know. I hope Jim Davis is the real Jim Davis and not some like weird porny Twitter that I've accidentally sent everyone to. Which would be,
yeah, you've sent everybody the to the dark web.
Yep, I sent everyone to weird Twitter accidentally.
He's like a super, like, oh God, just internet troll. Mine is, Twitter is at Beavs, B-E-A-V-S. That's regrettable, but you know.
It's your brand now. You have to live with it.
It's my brand. It's my history. It's forever me. And then my website is just alexneonike.com, which hasn't been updated in forever, so you can look at it still though.
And this bad Twitter account is scriptlockcast on Twitter. And with that, thank you two for both coming on and talking to us.
Oh, it was great. I really enjoyed it.
It was really fun.